reached 1,000 degrees, the paint began burning on the reactor's outer plating. There should have been a backup cooling system, something to stop catastrophe. But K-19 was an early design, a first attempt. Captain Yuri Pasachyov gave the order to surface. He tried to radio for help, but communications had failed. Meanwhile, engineers on board began desperately trying to improvise a new cooling system from the sub's drinking water reserves. They came up with a desperate plan. Several men were going to have to walk into the now highly radioactive reactor compartment and climb inside the boa's mouth. Lieutenant Boris Kerchilov was on his first submarine cruise, and he was the first to volunteer. Others from the reactor team followed. These men, still boys really, made their way into the compartment. There they stood, a team of eight, welding pipes, connecting them to pumps and valves. They remained in the compartment for 2 hours, braving the heat and the invisible particles that shot through their bodies. Each received 100 times the lethal dose of radiation. Ivan Kulikov, a 22-year-old chief petty officer, watched as they came out of the compartment, each man barely able to move, unable to speak, their faces changed beyond recognition. He watched horrified as the first team's efforts failed. As the cooling pumps came apart, it became clear that someone had to jury-rig the jury-rig. Kulikov volunteered. He was certain that he could do the work fastest, and he was just as certain that he was going to die trying. Kulikov's mind played back the faces of those first eight men, a running loop that wouldn't stop as he walked through a lake of radioactive water, ankle deep. As the water soaked through his leather shoes, as the radiation began to burn his feet, he thought he saw the walls and water shine, perhaps glow. His hands were burned as he opened valves to draw steam from the reactor. He could barely see. He could barely breathe. All he could do was pray that he could finish, make his way out, without falling headlong into the horrible, painful, radioactive lake that was already destroying his feet. Finally, he did get out, only to watch another valve fail, only to know he had to go back in. He had already taken in 5 times the lethal dose of radiation. Outside the compartment were the living dead. Back inside, he was more certain than ever that he was one of them. Then, just as the fuel rods reached 1,470 degrees, the pipes held, the valves held. The makeshift cooling system began to do its work. Kulikov stumbled out of the boa's mouth, and Captain Pasachyov turned K-19 around in a run toward the fleet they had left still conducting exercises a lifetime ago, at least 8 men's lifetimes ago. He knew he couldn't try for home. His entire crew would be fatally irradiated if he didn't get them off the sub fast. The team of eight, those first men into the compartment during the crisis, died before the week was out. They were buried in lead coffins. Pasachyov lingered longer, 3 weeks. Other crewmen who had come too close to the outer door of the reactor compartment lasted a month, some a little longer, before they too succumbed. Kulikov, whose feet and hands were irreparably burned, managed to survive with transfusions and bone marrow transplants. He would always be crippled. Even with all this, Moscow wasn't willing to let go of one of its few nuclear subs. Khrushchev was still racing the Americans. Men would one day be sent back into K-19, back into that reactor compartment. Only now K-19 would bear a new name. She would be known as the Hiroshima. The missile that was never launched. In 1962, the Soviet Navy wanted very much to appease Khrushchev, who wanted very much to see a nuclear submarine launch a ballistic missile from underwater. His naval leaders came forward with a sub that they told him would give him just what he demanded. Another success to herald in the Krasnaya Zvezda newspaper. Khrushchev witnessed just such a test, and was so delighted that he declared a reward for a perfect missile firing to the crew of the nuclear sub on display, the K-3, which had also just made a successful transit to the North Pole. Nobody would ever dare tell him he had just offered up an award for a clever illusion. The Soviet Navy was still having too many problems getting its nukes to shoot, much less shoot straight, to risk yet another failure with Khrushchev looking on. So instead of letting K-3 even make the attempt, commanders strategically positioned a Gulf diesel sub near the nuke. Hidden and in anonymity, it was the diesel boat that made the perfect shot. And so Soviet naval history marched on, intermingling the heroic, the tragic, and the comic. The Race to the Mediterranean. It was June 1967, the eve of the Arab-Israeli War, and the K-131 had been sent to the Adriatic Sea, outside the Mediterranean, to await orders from command. Those orders came as the first shots were fired. Captain Vadim Kulinchenko was given 15 hours to bring his sub in position to aim nuclear missiles at Tel Aviv. The captain was flabbergasted. He knew he didn't want to fire nuclear weapons at Israel, but he also knew he wouldn't have to. In order to make it from the Adriatic to the Mediterranean, in order to race past Greece, past Crete, and arrive within reach of Israel's coast, K-131 would have to somehow reach speeds of 57 knots. Her normal transit speed was 20 knots. He had to make a show of trying, but when the war ended 6 days later, Kulinchenko, K-131, and her nuclear weapons were still in transit. Eventually, he met up with his battle group in the Med, 40 surface ships and 10 diesel subs from the Black Sea Fleet. The K-131 didn't belong with this group. She wasn't from the Black Sea. But for their show of force in the Med, the Soviets wanted one of their new Northern Fleet nuclear submarines. It was a beginning. Soon the Med would be the new battleground in the submarine wars. For now, however, most of the Soviet Navy had little idea of what nuclear subs couldn't do, or for that matter, what they could. Indeed, before the war, when K-131 was on her way to the Adriatic, a supply ship helpfully offered fuel and water. Although the supply ship noted, those were two commodities it was running low on. "We have fresh water as much as you like," came the answer from the submarine. "We've just cooked it and are ready to give it to you." The Black Sea Fleet didn't have nuclear subs, and the astonished supply crew had no idea that water and fuel were two of the things any nuclear boat can produce for itself. Disaster strikes again. One of the next Soviet subs to travel to the Mediterranean was the K-3, the same sub that Khrushchev had awarded for the non-existent missile launch. Only this time, one of her officers, Lev Komorkin, had a bad feeling. 2 days before embarking from a port in the Barents, he walked with his 5-year-old daughter and a friend, who recalls him confiding, "I don't know why, but I don't want at all to go to this voyage." The feeling was so strong, the urge not to leave so powerful, that Komorkin swore that this would be his very last trip on a submarine. Sadly for the little girl who listened as her father talked of his misgivings, Komorkin was right. On September 8, 1967, at 1:52 a.m., a fire broke out in one of K-3's oxygen generators. She was returning from that run to the Mediterranean and was near home, just off the North Cape of Norway, just about where Cochino had suffered her first explosion. Showing much of the honor of Cochino's Rafael C. Benitez, Komorkin raced to prevent the fires from blowing the torpedoes and sinking his boat. He ordered everyone out of the weapons compartment and stayed behind to let the ocean in and flood the room. As he watched the waters rise to cover the torpedoes, he knew that he had engineered his own death. He drowned alongside the weapons. He would never know that 40 of the men he had tried so valiantly to save would succumb to carbon monoxide poisoning and die moments after he did. The Hiroshima makes a final appearance. The sub, already known as Hiroshima, continued to cause problems for the Soviet sub-command. In November 1969, she ran into the USS Gato with a blow that forced her into a steep bow-first dive, sending the huge volume of navigational astronomy tumbling down off a bookshelf and onto Captain Valentin Anatolievich Shabanov, who had been dozing. The collision also knocked out the sub's forward sonar and crushed the doors of her torpedo tubes. Still, Hiroshima continued to operate long enough for one final disaster. In 1972, fire broke out on the sub when she was about 600 miles northeast of Newfoundland. This time, 26 officers and crewmen were killed. There were 12 others who expected to die, men who were entombed inside the sub's stern compartment, unable to make it through the gassed portions of the sub. They stayed there for 23 days until Hiroshima limped home. That those 12 men lived is the only happy ending ever written for Hiroshima. She is remembered and memorialized as the submarine that earned her name for fire, radiation, and death. Trawlers and spies. The Soviets added a twist to the at-sea espionage routine by supplementing their fleets of subs with surface trawlers, specially equipped to eavesdrop, known as AGIs. There was a certain genius in this, since it was the cheapest and easiest way for the Soviet Union to post a sentry off all the major U.S. bases, both here and abroad. U.S. missile boats went to great lengths to avoid these trawlers. One sub even grounded in the late 1960s while trying to keep from being detected by an AGI lurking off Holyloch, Scotland. Mostly the trawlers just sat there, but sometimes they were downright brazen. That was the case in 1979 when the crew of one trawler operating near Guam reached out and grabbed a torpedo fired in a practice round by a U.S. missile sub, USS Sam Houston, SSBN 704. The trawler just rushed up, made the snatch, then began heading in a slow crawl back to the Soviet Union. Operational commanders were dumbstruck. They were also at a loss at just what to do. After some debate, they decided that sometimes there is no alternative to sending an obvious message, a show of military force, to make sure no other Soviet vessel ever tried anything this audacious again. Within 12 hours, two aircraft carrier battle groups were sent from Yokosuka and the Philippines to corner the trawler. A day or two later, the trawler was boxed in outside of Okinawa. By now, the Navy had gotten the State Department involved, and messages were flying back and forth between U.S. diplomats and high-ranking Soviets. Finally, the trawler captain, who had stared down the American ships, dropped the torpedo over the side. Attached was a note, written in English, deft and to the point. The captain simply said the torpedo had come alongside his ship. To naval intelligence officers looking on, it seemed as though the Soviet was saying, "Look what I found," as if he had just landed a big fish, and it was the most natural and innocent thing in the world. Death in the Norwegian Sea. In the late summer of 1985, the USS Baltimore, SSN 704, was sent to watch a Soviet Zulu 4 sub in waters just above Norway. The U.S. Navy knew that the 1950s vintage diesel sub was a research boat, one that had been seen loitering in the area before. The Baltimore prepared to make a pass beneath the Zulu when the American submariners saw a cable about as wide as a man's arm dangling from the Soviet sub. Then, through a murky underwater periscope view, they saw the Soviets lowering an open underwater sled with ballast tanks on either side. On the sled were one or more divers wearing suits reminiscent of those designed for outer space, with air hoses connected back up to the submarine. Silence was ordered on board Baltimore as the Soviet sled moved toward the ocean floor. Men were ordered to wear their rubber shoes, not to slam doors. The ice machine was turned off. So was the bug juice machine. The only thing left running in Baltimore's mess was the coffee maker. Soon, sonar reported the sound of what seemed to be digging in the sand 300 feet below the surface. Listening in on the Zulu's own onboard intercom, the Baltimore's crew realized that the Soviets were looking for an underwater communications cable. Naval intelligence officials knew that there was such a cable there, one running from Murmansk to northern England, that had been laid in the days of the Tsar. It wasn't used anymore, and the Soviets had to have known that. Perhaps the Soviets were practicing. Perhaps they were preparing to try to match the U.S. cable-tapping feat that had been exposed a few years earlier. Or perhaps they were practicing to disrupt the cables that connected the U.S. SOSUS nets. The oceans were rough, with swells reaching as high as 30 feet. Still, the Zulu loitered, and still the Baltimore watched, from one day to the next. On the third day, all sounds of digging, all noise, in fact, stopped. Baltimore was inched closer, and her crew realized that there was now a cable dangling from the Zulu, with no sled attached. It had been lost, presumably with its divers. A stunned silence reigned on Baltimore. I remember that everyone in the con turned around and looked at each other, one crew member said, adding that it no longer seemed to matter which side anybody was on. It was more like we realized a submariner was dead.
This concludes Appendix B, from the Soviet side.
In the spring of 1999, authors Sherry Sontag and Christopher Drew paid a visit to the recording studios of Recorded Books to talk to interviewer Denise Longto about the writing of Blind Man's Bluff.
Today we're happy to have with us in the studios of Recorded Books author Sherry Sontag, who with co-author Christopher Drew and researcher Annette Lawrence Drew wrote the New York Times bestseller Blind Man's Bluff, The Untold Story of American Submarine Espionage. Welcome, Sherry.
Hi.
Can you tell our listening audience who just had the pleasure of hearing your book the genesis of the idea for Blind Man's Bluff?
You know, it really came about after the Cold War. Chris began it. It was when he was at the Chicago Tribune. And they just began to wonder, now that it's all over, what did submarines really do? And he started to go out and ask questions, and then I joined him in time to start doing the book, which, by the way, was 6 years in the making. And it was interesting because you could only get crumbs of it at first. These men had signed secrecy oaths. They had not told their wives or their children or their parents where they had been, what they had done. So little bit by little bit, almost like an archaeological dig, we dug this all up and then we put it back together to tell the story. The amazing thing is 6 years later is the response. We weren't sure exactly how we'd be greeted because this was all based on classified information. But the men have come out by the hundreds, by the thousands, to meet us and to say thank you. Thank you so much. We heard from one man who heard from his ex-wife who called him up to say, I'm sorry, I didn't understand the pressures you were under. We've heard that families are sitting down and talking for the first time. This has literally changed thousands of men's lives. So what began as just a spark of curiosity has really snowballed into something quite remarkable.
How many stories had Christopher Drew published in the newspaper before he decided, in fact, he had a book and then he sought you out or you sought him out? I'm not sure how the story goes.
Chris did a series of page one stories for the Trib of 6 stories, and the way he likes to tell it is that it was the first series of articles he'd ever done where he realized he had just scratched the surface. We were good friends from a group called Investigative Reporters and Editors. And in fact, while he was reporting the articles, he would call me up almost daily to tell me what it was he was finding out. So I was following this in real time. And by the time it was over, we decided there had to be a book. The nice thing is 7 years later, we've come full circle. Investigative Reporters and Editors gave us their award this year.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, it was
What's
nice.
The name of that award?
It's considered the Investigative Reporters and Editors
That's
Award.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. We also got an award from the Navy League. It was the Navy League and the Theodore and Franklin Roosevelt Foundation. And we got their Best Book Award this year as well.
I note that the authorship of the book credits Annette Lawrence Drew as your researcher. I imagine a book of this type entails years of amassing and sorting through pertinent research. What sort of research did she do, and how did you work together with her in collaborating to put together the stories?
Well, Annette did some very crucial things. There were unfortunately very few documents for any of this because, again, the documents were classified. But in some of the early chapters, there were documents, and she was able to get a hold of those for us. She also created a timeline. It was very important to us in telling the story that we always have a sense of what was going on above the waves while we were telling the story under. And we really wanted to put those pieces together. So what Annette did is for every year from the end of World War II through the end of the Cold War, she created a timeline. She went through books, she went through newspapers and everything else. So at any time I was writing, if I needed to see March of 72, I can call it up on my computer and there it was in detail.
Huh. Now, you are both investigative reporters, so you yourself were responsible for a great deal of research, primary sources, and interviews. Can you share a little bit with us what that process was like for you of finding your sources?
The book is based on interviews. In fact, while many books have six or seven key sources and then other people fill in, we never had that. This was, as I said, an archaeological dig, one little bit at a time, one man at a time, 1 hour at a time. You also couldn't do these on the phone. You couldn't call up somebody and say, by the way, I'm going to ask you about stuff you never told your family. You wouldn't tell your best friends. So basically, we flew around the country. And we would call people up and say, can we come over? We didn't get them a whole lot of time to think about it, but we didn't go knocking on their door without an announcement either. And then we would sit down with them. And sometimes people said, we just don't want to talk to you, and they called the Navy. Sometimes people would have us in, and there would be hours before they opened up, if they opened up at all. And then usually it was only a little bit. There were letters going around and alerts going around as we hit different parts of the country from the Navy, as the Navy warned people that we were in town and reminded them of their secrecy oaths. Sometimes when the people called into the Navy, they were, again, reminded of their secrecy oaths, although some of those people did choose to speak to us anyway, others didn't. The interesting thing is we thought the Navy could have been stronger. The Navy probably could have threatened jail time or, you know, if you violate your secrecy oath, we'll do something terrible to you. It seemed to be sort of a strange in-between response. We started this book with Navy support after Chris's series, which was quickly rescinded when they realized that we were going to talk about events that happened, as they said, late in the game. The Navy defined late in the game as anything past 1950.
Well, that sort of covers the bulk of your book, with the exception of the first chapter, doesn't it?
With the exception of the first chapter, yeah. So it was very clear that we were going to have to go forward without Navy support.
I wondered about the cable tapping, particularly the later information of it, how threatened they would feel about exposing that, not just to the readership, but to people around the world? Or is this just something that goes on all the time?
Well, there are really two answers to that. First, the fact of cable tapping, the fact that we could do it, that we had the capacity and did indeed do it, was already out. The spy Ronald Pelton told the Soviets there was a cable tap at the bottom of the Sea of Okhotsk. The Soviets sent a survey ship. They reached down and pulled this thing up, and in case they had any doubt as to who put it there, when they opened it up, there was a part emblazoned with the words, Property of the United States. What wasn't out is a story. You didn't know there was a Captain Jim Bradley out there who had come up with the idea just because it made sense there would be a cable, and then helped find the cable by remembering the signs he saw along the Mississippi River when his mom dragged him on riverboat rides when he was a kid. Now, the fact that we had a cable tap in the Barents had not been reported before. But basically what we did, and what we did with most of this, is we told the human story behind it. Any submarine buff could have told you submarines trailed other submarines. Nobody could have told you about Captain Whitey Mack, who trailed a Soviet Yankee sub for 47 days in what we call the near-biblical feat. Nobody could have told you what it was like, how these things happened. You could have known one line, but that was it. And that's not really knowing the history at all. That's like saying, well, we fought the Revolutionary War, you know, end of discussion. So on the one hand, yes, it was very sensitive. The Navy did react. When I was in various states reporting on this, we would discover that some people I had gone to visit had been visited the next day by the Naval Investigative Service. Now, sometimes it left us a little, gee, I wonder if we're being followed. But most of the time we realized that they knew what years we were focusing on by virtue of who we were calling. They knew pretty much what boats by then we were focusing on by virtue of people calling in and saying we had asked questions. So it was probably just a matter of coincidence. They were going to reach these people sooner or later. Again, some people chose not to talk to us, and some people, and some very high-ranking people, in fact, some of the people who were responsible for these missions or for sending the subs out in the first place, were very much behind helping us do this. They realized that a lot of what was still classified was no longer going on. We were no longer tapping cables against the Soviet Union. And Chris and I deliberately did not go after ongoing missions. And we also didn't go after guys who were still active unless they were very high rank and knew exactly what they were doing. We did that for two reasons. We didn't go after guys who were still active because we wanted to underscore the fact that we weren't interested in compromising what was going on today. So we felt that we were being very careful. It's just that when you have a bureaucracy based on something called the silent service, which is what the submarine service is, it's very hard to turn around and get that culture to break down and realize, okay, now it's okay to talk.
Yet, in fact, the Navy read your manuscript, approved of it, and only asked that two things be removed?
No. The Navy did not read our manuscript and approve it. What happened was, in order to double-check ourselves, to make sure we were doing no harm, Chris and I went to several of the people who had worked hardest to stop us. And very unofficially, we did not ask for formal approval. As journalists would not ask for formal approval. That is just not something that you do.
Right.
What we did do is we said, here's a chance. You could read this thing. And if you think there's something in here that could do damage, you can talk to us about it. They read this manuscript, all three, and they turned around and said, you know what? This is pretty good. Can you take out the name of that antenna over there? You know, it's old technology, but we don't want people to know we're still using it. Fine. It was in there for color for us. This is a book more about people than technology. And they basically said, and where you stop the story is fine. Can you please not look too closely into what Parchee is doing now? If you remember, Parchee was the cable tapping boat that's still out there. So what we did is, and we had always intended to only do this, we say Parchee's still out there. We say we know she's not tapping cables against the Russians. And then we say, you know, and she's capable of tapping cables, and here's the Navy's assessment of its own hotspots. And out of Navy publications, we pull out China, North Korea, you know, Iran.
Yeah.
We had never intended to say exactly what Parchee was doing now because, quite frankly, if she's found a way to listen in on another set of bad guys, we'd just as soon let her. So then they turned around and said, by the way, you know, now that I'm reading this, I remember this, this, and this. And they gave us another dozen or so details that really helped drive the story along. Now, that was not a formal approval process. That was Chris and I wanting to be responsible and going to the people who would be most likely to give us a hard time.
That was very smart. Is that a professional step that most investigative reporters would take, or did you really go above and beyond the call of duty in doing that?
You know, there's always a debate when you're dealing with any form of story. Do you give people a heads up as to what's coming, or do you let it come out? I think normally you err on the side of not letting it come out, because you don't want to put yourself in the position of asking permission, and it can get very sticky. At the same time, we felt that under these circumstances and with this kind of a story, that we needed to do this.
How did you and Christopher work as a team? Did you divide up the various stories, each chapter being its own submarine espionage adventure, or did you pass them back and forth, working on each of them together?
We passed it back and forth. The tough thing about writing this book is we didn't have the luxury of money or time to go after one chapter at a time, which would have been a lot easier. We broke it up geographically. Oh. When I was in California, I would find every guy I could from every boat we might even remotely be interested in, do those interviews. So later, unraveling all the stuff became very difficult. I mean, because you repeat that for 50 states and maybe several trips to one state and everything else, and you have all these interviews that you've done. And normally as a writer, when I'm doing a story, I'll interview and I'm almost writing in my head as I go along. When you're doing so much at once, you can't craft it in an ongoing way. So Chris really had a lot to do with unraveling it and reorganizing. And then I would sit down and bang out a draft of this. And then we'd bounce it back and forth until we both liked it.
So you were basically interviewing to find out what stories there were, what additional stories besides the ones that had been published in the newspaper accounts.
Oh, we have several stories that weren't in the newspaper accounts. You can normally tell when one boat was more important in one era than another. You can go, then you could track that. Then what you would do is you would just talk to absolutely anybody on surrounding who might have heard in any incarnation that might be related to that era that you could. And then you would then go back, because one guy who was in the engine room may remember things differently from a guy who was in the control room. And you really had to make sure that that the person who was telling you the story was actually there, or that you've gotten a hold of the people who were there, and that their memories 10, 20, 30 years ago could then be reconciled. So it was an ongoing sifting process.
And did you have to select stories? Did any fall by the wayside? Or did you use primarily...
No, we didn't use everything that we had. But a lot of stories fell by the wayside. And, in fact, we cut out from our first draft to our second draft, we cut out 200 pages. We did that mainly because after we told the story of, say, Whitey Mack trailing the Soviet Yankee for 47 days, how many more trailing stories did anybody want to read? There were some great trailing stories that could have been in there.
Can you do a part two to the book, just more stories? Do you think you'd have an audience for that?
We talk about this a lot. We know there'd be an audience for more stories from Blind Man's Bluff. At the same time, it would be very difficult to do it with the historical integrity that we did this.
In terms of the chronology?
Well, all of these stories, they not only come in order, but that they really help put together the overall picture of sub-spying. It's one of the reasons we try not to repeat kinds of incidents.
Right.
You know, we try to keep the story moving forward so you, at any given time, you really have a sense of why you're reading what you're reading. So it's a great tale and you've got great characters, but it's also giving you that part of the history that you need to know. Honestly, we think that the best next book on submarines would be what they're doing now, and that we wouldn't want to touch for another 10 years or so, because they're doing it now.
Who was your favorite character that you interviewed or reported on, and why?
I have a lot of favorite characters. I just love the creativity. You know, it's not what you expect when you approach a military book to find a John Craven who likes to spout biblical verse and maxims of the sea and sing the result out loud, or a Jim Bradley who's going to, you know, figure out a way to do our most sensitive ever mission by remembering that we had signs on the beach saying cable crossing, do not anchor. I love the fact that these men did not fit any kind of a stereotype of the military. So I had a favorite character for every chapter. I mean, I love Whitey Mack. I mean, who expects a 6'6" captain to be running around shouting over blueberries, you know, on one of the most crucial missions of the Cold War? I love Benitez, who was on the Cochino, who, against all hope, as his boat is exploding under his feet, is still praying that he could take this thing in tow and bring it home, and literally, like out of the movies, refuses to get off it until it is seconds away from sinking.
How did you take the stories and the facts and then render them with such a dramatic and compelling narrative? You don't often see that in newspaper investigative reporting because there simply isn't the room for it.
Well, there's a difference between news and books. In news, the news story is driven by the news. In books, we believe that the story should be driven by the story, and that the news becomes the details, the same way somebody's eye color becomes a detail in what you're writing. It wasn't a lot of work to tell this in a dramatic way. In fact, the difficult thing was not in over-dramatizing. It was in letting the story speak for itself. And we just remembered that we were storytelling, and we remembered how we felt the first time we heard these stories, and we let it go from there.
It's just an excellent job.
Well, thank
you. Very cinematic, even.
We did think about movies a lot. You know, we did think about movies a lot. Well, and if this were a movie, could we have a scene that flashed back to Washington? And it was written that way.
This is a little bit about the post-publication of the book. I understand that there was a town where you and Christopher had hoped to have a Barnes & Noble book signing, but the Barnes & Noble decided there wouldn't be enough buyers in attendance. Could you share with us the story of the former Navy man who rented the hall for you?
Actually, it happened a little bit backwards from that. What happened was we had a very small advertising budget. The original printing of this book was going to be 25,000 copies, and Chris and I thought I could do better. So we started to try to do whatever we could to push the book forward. And I got on the Internet, and I wrote this letter that basically said the book was coming out, and here's the, you know, the first four or five towns we're going to on book tour, and, you know, please show up. And on top of the letter, I wrote, please forward to whoever you think would be interested. Well, on the fifth forward, and you know, an email you can count because it keeps adding FWD, 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 it reached this old spook called George Knutson. George emailed me back, and he said, you know, why are you going to Seattle? All the submariners are in Bremerton and Silverdale, which is about a couple hours away, you know? And you can't expect people to drive 2 hours just to go to a book signing. So I wrote back, fine, get a bookstore in your area to host me, and I'll be there. I had an extra day on tour. He wrote back that he'd spoken to the Barnes & Noble, but they had never heard of either me or Chris, and therefore they weren't interested. So I wrote back to George that, well, maybe if he can get five guys together in his basement, I'd read for them. Because quite frankly, I thought it was a lot more interesting to spend time with submariners than it was to sit in a hotel room. Well, he got a little carried away. He rented the community center out. And then he went back to Barnes & Noble as he began to get responses from people who wanted to attend. And they agreed that they would bring 50 books to the event. Well, they got these 50 books in a couple weeks in advance, and they sold out that day. Then they got another 50 books for the event, and another, and another. The night before the event, they were down to zero books. The manager of the store drove around Washington State and literally cannibalized Blind Man's Bluff from every other store she could, every other Barnes & Noble, and showed up with, I think it was another 250. And all but like 50 of those went. And I signed about 500 books that night. The Barnes & Noble decided it wanted to use this book in a contest. Each Barnes & Noble is allowed to back a horse. They're allowed to pick the book that they want to hand sell that month. And the store that sells the most of the books it had picked wins this contest. So they decided, the same Barnes & Noble that didn't want to host an event originally, decided that they would pick Blind Man's Bluff pre-Christmas. They sold 2,000 copies out of that one store in 1 month. I then later came back to Silverdale. George re-rented out the community center. 300 people showed up. And I don't even remember how many books I signed. What I do remember is at 11 o'clock at night, I started to timestamp. At midnight, I changed the date on the books. That people at the end of the line were being served coffee and cookies from what we call the church ladies, the women who were running around and feeding everybody and keeping everybody in good cheer. And the signing, I think, took 6 hours.
That's wonderful. Now, was he Knudsen, a former Navy man?
Yeah, he was a spook. He was a
Navy
spy.
Right. So often these days, the story behind the story of how a book came to be is as interesting as the story itself. And in your case, I understand a large publishing house had initially been interested in the book, decided they couldn't find an audience for it. You went with a small press, ended up on the New York Times bestseller list. Can you tell us a little bit about that journey?
How delicate of you to say a large publisher. We originally had a contract with Simon & Schuster. And we worked for 5 years, and we dutifully sent Simon & Schuster a copy of every chapter we wrote. In the middle of this, our original editor, the fellow who paid for the book, took off for another publishing house. So we were now an adopted book from another editor. There came a time when a lot of the publishers began to dump titles. They all decided that their lists were too fat. HarperCollins made headlines for it, but everybody else was doing it too. And Simon & Schuster looked up and decided that they were going to cancel our book. They already had the first draft. They had already called me up to say that the writing was terrific. We called them to tell them our second draft was going to be in within days. And they said, well, it's too late. We've canceled you.
Do you have to give back an advance in an instance like this?
Well, you know, it's funny. The contract says if you're canceled for market reasons, and they said they were canceling us because the Cold War was over and nobody would care what these guys did anymore. Under those conditions, we're not supposed to have to give back the advance. But the publisher could always argue that the book was somehow not satisfactory. And so we ended up with a deal where we would give back the advance as other money came in, as the book began to sell. Simon & Schuster ditched it. our agent, Esther Newberg at ICM, basically declared war and found us another publisher in 2 weeks. In this case, she found Public Affairs, headed up by Peter Osnos, who was the former editor at Random House's Times Books. And Peter had started his own imprint because in a world where Paolo Barbieri was getting a $3 million advance, he realized there was not a lot of room left for books by journalists and historians. He decided good books should and could be written if somebody just created an outlet. And so he created Public Affairs. He took us on as pretty much a leap of faith. He liked the book, and he thought, okay, we'll see how many it could sell. But now we're with the smaller publisher. It's their first list. There's only so much advertising anybody could do, although Peter was remarkable in the creative ways he found to advertise our book with us. And in how long he kept us on the road, we had a 7-month book tour that's unheard of. And he just was very supportive of us, and the book began to take off. Now, Chris and I always knew that the Submariners would want this. Nobody had ever told their story before. I mean, Hunt for October exists, but it's fiction. You know, these guys had never been able to look and say, yes, I was there, on anything in print. And so we used email, we used postcards, we used absolutely anything we could think of to reach Submariners. The only thing that surprised us was how quickly this book jumped to the general audience. When we started selling out in Phoenix, where there are very few Submariners, because Submariners tend to settle around water, not desert, and in Manhattan, where there are also very few Submariners, we knew that we had something. We ended up staying on the New York Times bestseller list for 21 weeks. If you count the time on what's known as the extended list, the top 35, it's really closer to 8 months.
How has this changed your life as an investigative journalist and as a writer, this success?
Well, aside from the fact that my family no longer considers me unemployed, I don't know. Honestly, I'm just looking for the next book. I think I have a basic understanding that this will now no longer be an if, but a when. But for the most part, the book was the book was the book before the success. If we had sold 500 copies or close to 400,000, as it turns out to be the case, it still would have been the book and the best I could have done. I'm glad it did well. I am so glad that these men are embracing it and that they're coming to meet us and everything else.
Well, that's an element which many things don't have anymore, of catharsis in real life because of what you've written for these people. It's a cathartic event that they can share with their families. And, you know, you say yourself, I think in the notes, you talk about the wives who didn't know where their husbands were all this time.
Or the men who couldn't talk about it. It's amazing when you meet these men and you ask a question as simple as how old are your children? And it engenders tears, and you realize they're crying because the question also says to them, how many years did you miss? So I always said that as a journalist, I wanted to write things that wouldn't be written if I weren't on the planet. And then you go into a newspaper, and you're basically chasing the latest headline, the latest tidbit, and the latest scandal. It's sort of like Monica's belt. And suddenly, I found I was in a position to write something that wouldn't have been on this planet if I didn't exist and if Chris didn't exist and if Annette didn't exist. It is why we became journalists in the first place. And it's so rare that in real life it actually plays out that way.
What are some topics or issues that are of personal concern to you that might fit that category of you just spoke about?
What I'm looking for in the next topic is something that makes me feel the way I felt when Chris and I first started talking about Blind Man's Bluff. And in a word, I just wanted to say, Cole, what a great world. What an interesting world. There was just something that I was just fascinated by from the minute he said submarine spying. And there's a mystique to submarines. It's not just a military book. There's something special about men who would give up the sun, their families, go under all that water and take these kinds of risks in these machines that have caught the imagination since Da Vinci. I mean, it's just fascinating stuff. And I really wanted to explore that. I'm looking for the next thing that makes me just go, wow.
What was it that Da Vinci said about submarines?
He drew a prototype, proto-submarine, what he called it, in one of his notebooks, and then said he would not say how it would work because he feared the evil nature of men who would use it to bring death from the deep or something. That's not a direct quote, but it's close enough. The Seawolf Storm was one of the hardest things to dig up. And that was because these men were not only bound by their secrecy agreements, but they had come very close to dying. And they come back from this, and they can't tell anyone. And the resentment about not being able to tell turns inside out until it's a badge of honor. They won't tell no matter what. You know how that could happen. You resent something so much it becomes your badge of honor. And we had heard from somebody who wasn't on the boat that Seawolf had gone to tap the cable, the Soviets were there waiting, and divers died. Now, we knew instantly that wasn't the story. The guy was not on the boat, it wasn't the story. But we also knew there might be a story somewhere along those lines. So we started contacting people on Seawolf within a certain number of years of that this man had pinpointed, or not quite pinpointed, to just sort of pointed out. And people were hanging up with the phone on us right and left. Finally, I make another call, and the voice on the other end of the line says, I'm not going to talk to a reporter, and I'm getting off the phone. I'm going to do target practice. And I was a little desperate. So I said, are you going to give up your chance to teach a 5-foot-tall New York City woman journalist how to shoot a gun? Well, I couldn't resist. He invited me over for target practice. So we shot a Colt 45 and a 9mm Beretta and a 357 Magnum. And by the way, when they go boom, boom, boom and keep pulling the trigger, it ain't true. One pull of that trigger and your finger is tired. But it was over the rifle that this man just let me know that nobody had died and the Soviets weren't waiting and that Seawolf was stuck. Well, to me, stuck meant gudgeon. Destroyers overhead dropping depth charges. What else does stuck mean in a submarine? It took another dozen or so interviews before we realized that Seawolf had become buried in the sand at the bottom of the Kotsk. A few more interviews before we had a sample of the sand, and I actually was given one of the rocks from the bottom of a Kotsk on book tour.
Did you meet the man who had thought to cut the anchors? Wasn't that what finally freed them?
No, they did cut the anchors, but they also rocked themselves out, small emergency blows, and it was the chiefs that took over. I won't say who I did and did not talk to specifically on any of these things. I can't.
There was only the one story, maybe you can tell me before I ask and we cut it, was the second cable tapping mission, was it in the Barents Sea, where the crew was disgruntled because they realized it wasn't wartime. They were doing something
actually,
that was illegal.
It was actually part of the first. Halibut goes and taps the cable, and then they pull back for a little while, and then she goes back. And the crew become we love the story about Halibut and the crew becoming concerned, the chiefs becoming concerned, because it was one of the things that made us totally understand that these men were thoughtful men.
They were conflicted.
They were not blind automatons, and they were conflicted a lot about what they had to do. In the end, they decided it was the most important thing that they could do, but they wondered. They wondered, could they be starting the very war they were there to prevent? I mean, how would the Soviets react if they found our submarine tapping their cable within a sea that fit as neatly into the Soviet Union as our Chesapeake Bay fits into our own eastern seaboard? In the end, only one man chose not to go back out, and the other men did. But it's a very funny thing. If you look at the history of this, we're asking a lot of these men, but what they're confronted with is the reality of nuclear war in a way that almost nobody else is. For most of us, nuclear war was a sort of fear somewhere in the background. For these men, they were following the submarines with the nuclear missiles on them. They can't tell their wives and families why they're gone. The wives and families may even resent it, but they know that in the most direct way possible, they are literally in the position to protect their wives and families from being hit by a nuclear weapon. So how do you come home? The question's always been, what else? After Kachina goes down, we lose our, remember, this is our first submarine spying mission. You know, we're not ready for it. We lose the submarine. We would have lost everybody on board had there not been another sub to transfer these men to. And even so, the transfer is so dangerous, we lose 7 guys. The minute this all happens and Tusk comes back toting Cochino and Tusk's men, the other thing that happens is the Soviets explode the first atomic bomb, their first atomic bomb. So the question becomes, what else are we going to do? So we keep sending spy subs off the coast of the Soviet Union. Then you come to the Gudgeon, right? And what happens? Gudgeon gets held down. I I mean, she's supposed to surface for every 12 hours, and she's held down for 64 hours without air.
The carbon monoxide.
So, with carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide building up, and Gudgeon is forced to come to the surface. Now we know in no uncertain terms, we're vulnerable. At least the submarines we are most using for spying are vulnerable. Because remember, we have not yet used nuclear submarines. These are diesel submarines. So you could question the mission then. But the next time we surface a Soviet sub, we do the same thing to it that it did with the Soviets did to Gudgeon. Well, what comes up? The first Zulu that the Soviets had modified to carry nuclear weapons. All of a sudden, that fear we had had since the end of World War II that the Soviets would A, develop the bomb and find out a way to put it in missiles and carry it on submarines is true. So again, the question becomes, what else? You start tapping cables. You are listening to literally the Soviets' own assessments of successes and failures. You're getting an ear to their intentions, an ear to who the other guy is. It's enormously dangerous, but there's no other way to get this intelligence. What else?
How did you think...
This was a mission built on necessity.
Did your own views of war and espionage change after writing this book?
Well, yes and no. I think... As a journalist, I really try to approach everything without any form of preconceived notion. But at the same time, I'm a New York City kid.
You're a child of the 60s, aren't you?
Well, yeah, but very much a child of the 60s. Usually you'd figure a teenager in the 60s mm-hmm. would be what you'd consider a child of the 60s.
Right.
I was 8 years old during the 68 riots. But you grow up with the discomfort about war. You certainly don't. In New York, you don't really know a lot of military men or military families or military women in this day and age, too, although there are no women on submarines. So I didn't know what to expect. I did know that I couldn't automatically make the assumption that these guys would all be out pro-war and out for blood and everything else. I had already worked for the National Law Journal. One of the first things you think when you go in is that the government's going to be the big heavy-handed government and the defense lawyers are going to be the good guys. And then you realize the government lawyers are trying to do the best job they can with almost no resources and the defense lawyers are the ones who are the fat cats. So I've already had my world turned upside down enough to know I can't know what to expect. What I didn't realize is just how thoughtful these men would be, just how unbloodthirsty and caring they would be. Another pivotal moment for us was realizing that after the Tautog collided with the Soviet sub, that the men on the Tautog were just bereft of the idea that Soviet submariners may have died. They were just intelligent, warm, kind people who were doing the best job that they could.
For all of us.
For all of us. And so I didn't realize just how much I would come to respect and like them. But I really did. I think they did a really good job. Now, that doesn't mean that things didn't go wrong. But it was okay.
There's great honor in their stories.
And sometimes men are at their best when things are at their worst.
I know that I, for one, will look differently at the oceans after having read your and Christopher's book. I never knew that so much was going on underneath the oceans, for one thing. One of the things that I had a question about, though, was in terms of what happens to the nuclear warheads that find their way to the bottom of the ocean from these submarines. Are they automatically diffused? I mean, what happens
well,
to the environment with all of this?
There aren't that many warheads at the bottom. I mean, when we retire a submarine, we don't send it to the bottom.
No, but some of them had been irretrievably sunk, like that had warheads,
Well, the only missile submarine that was sunk was the Soviet's Gulf. Our two submarines were sunk were attack subs, Scorpion and Thresher. Well, the bigger danger is what happens to the reactors. The Soviets dumped a lot of reactors into the Barents Sea. That cleanup is still facing them. There's enormous pollution there. I'm a lot less afraid of the one intact Gulf warhead that's 3 miles down than I am of the Soviet reactors rotting in the Barents.
So they do just rot at the bottom of the ocean.
Well, you don't put reactors to sit in the sea. I don't quite understand why the Soviets chose that way to dispose of some of their old subs. I mean, they're rotting dockside and everything else. They didn't, so there's a mess there that needs to be fixed up. Normally reactors are removed from subs. Submarines are broken apart for scrap, at least on our end. We don't have that same kind of cleanup. But no, there are not a whole lot of nuclear missiles lying on the bottom of the ocean.
Did you use the Freedom of Information Act as a primary source for research at all, or was it not really that important?
We used FOIA to try to get the documents in Scorpion, which don't seem to exist. But there's not a lot you can FOIA when things are classified. That's a perfect reason to say no. So, no, we use FOIA to a limited extent, but for the most part, this was just sitting down man by man, person by person. It's why it was a 6-year process.
Did you ever ride a submarine during your research?
Yeah, I went and toured the Sixth Fleet in the Mediterranean, and I got to go down on the Billfish. I also got launched off an aircraft carrier and got to swoop down on a P-3 Orion Subhunter as it swept right over the waves.
Well, there's not many women in Manhattan who can claim that.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background as an investigative journalist? I understand you've written for The Times and you work for the National Law Journal. And
then I met Chris.
And then you met Chris. And then I met Chris. Happy ever after.
Yeah.
Your book gives the sense that this part of the submarine saga is over. The spying, the danger, the imminent threat of nuking each other via the seas. And yet you mentioned this, I think, in the last page of your book, about Iran having 3 kilo subs, and I believe that China has recently ordered or will have 10 subs by the end of this year.
Actually, submarine spying isn't over. There is still spying going on.
It's escalated and changed its geography? Or?
Well, what it is, it's less of it. We no longer have to trail Soviet missile boats around the waters. But we're keeping an eye on Russia, about maybe 10% of what we did against the Soviet Union. We're keeping an eye on other countries. The submarine force is indeed reinventing itself. Now it's trying to integrate better into carrier groups. They were used in Kosovo. For example, submarines shot Tomahawk missiles while we were bombarding Kosovo. They kept an eye on the waters in case the Russians decided to send submarines in. They could shoot the first missile from a given area before anybody realized we were going to go to that area, because everything else has to bring its whole, you know, surface support fleet with it. A submarine is totally self-contained. It makes its own air. It makes its own fuel. You know, you don't need anything but the submarine. They're reinventing themselves right now. They did that at the end of World War II, which is how, I mean, during World War II, submarines were basically surface ships that could dive long enough to shoot a torpedo and evade capture and had to come up for air. They only became spy boats, significant spy boats, after World War II. So now we take what we know about being battle boats, and we take what we know about being spy boats, and we take what we know about the world, and we see where they come up next.
Hmm. Did anyone allude to the fact that China is of great concern to this country with their 10 subs coming up?
Nobody is going to be the kind of adversary that in the near future anyway, that the Soviet Union was. The Soviet Union outnumbered us in submarines, and they had a lot of submarines bringing nuclear missiles near our shores, or certainly within shooting range as years went by. That was further and further from our shores. But one submarine, even a diesel, even not a new diesel, can do a lot of damage.
I had no idea until reading your book.
So you need to keep an eye on them. And there are other ways that you can keep an eye on your adversary, even if you're not just tracking their other submarines. Remember, you've got a totally hidden platform. China is a concern generally. Therefore, you know, our submarines are probably hanging around.
The saying goes, a good offense is the best defense. And yet I found while reading your book the American Navy seemed to be perpetually on the defense. Is that a misconception?
Yeah, it is. We were way ahead when it came to spying. We were much quieter. We were much more effective. We spied on the Soviets a lot more than they spied on us. In fact, we did it with technology and subs. They did a lot more with human spies. At one point, until the very end of the Cold War, we were so good at tracking Soviet missile boats that had there been a World War III, we probably could have taken a good number of their missile boats out before they could have ever fired. That began to change toward the end of the war when the Soviets realized they could hide their boats under the Arctic ice and it would be very difficult to follow them. No, but we were very much ahead. We were watching out for nuclear missiles on submarines before they exploded their first atomic bomb, and certainly before they put them on submarines.
Had any members of your immediate family or Christopher's family or Annette's family been involved in Cold War activities in the armed forces?
No, none of us. Annette's father, I believe, was an architect. My dad's a professor. We came to this just out of curiosity. We were not military brats, and we were not children of spies, you know, little spooklets or anything like that. We were just curious.
Your book reads almost like a collective biography told in episodic vignettes. I mean, how would you describe your book?
A really good yarn, just a fun read.
Something
that'll tell you something you didn't know.
After reading your book, I, being somewhat of an optimist, like I'm sure many of our listeners are, I started to have question my faith in peace accords, SALT talks, and other agreements between warring countries. I mean, your book really put things in perspective. You know, while we were, can you talk about that and what that was like encountering that? You know, when we were having the SALT talks, there's all this espionage going on underneath the waters.
Or is that just business as usual? It's business as
usual.
You come to realize first that our government, not even any one branch of your government, is a monolith. That, you know, you can be talking peace on the one hand. On the other hand, you could be keeping an eye on the other guy. And, you know, at first when we were writing, we wondered, well, is this the right thing to do? Then we kind of came to the conclusion that it probably was. Because I think a lot of what we did help bring, I mean, a lot of the submarine spying helped bring about the end of the Cold War. In part, it helped to bankrupt the Soviet Union as they tried to keep up with us. The other thing that it did is it actually at one point eased tensions. If you remember, Reagan came in and the Cold War rhetoric was very, very hot. It was through a cable tap in the Barents that we learned that the Soviets, reacting to an exercise, a military exercise we were having, thought we might be readying for a first strike. The rhetoric had just gotten crazy on both sides, all that evil empire talk. And the next thing you know, both sides have pulled back. They're both being a lot more careful with one another. We realize from when we finally hear these tapes that, because remember, they sit at the bottom of the sea for a while before we go and retrieve them, that the Soviets, one, thought we were capable of first strike, and two, that their response was totally defensive. Gorbachev was not yet in power, but he was very close to the center of things while the Soviets were readying for what may be our first strike. So both Reagan and Gorbachev now have a real good idea of what the rhetoric can do, and they both pull back. I think that you just can't assume that because we're negotiating peace that everybody's going to just sort of shake hands. It does become more dangerous to spy in those times because you could shake the peace accords. But to a large degree, I think it became very clear that both sides realized what the other side was doing. And they weren't going to be all that shocked by the fact that they were being spied on. As we like to say, it did not start World War III. We get to see this in retrospect. And in retrospect, SALT could have been discussed, we were spying, and it wouldn't have shocked anybody.
One of the things your book does is sort of expose the sibling rivalry between the CIA and the Navy, and this incompetence that seemed to happen at the hands of the CIA. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, back in 69 through the 70s, there was a definite rivalry between the two. And the CIA, at least when it came to projects involving the Navy, did not keep its secrets very well. I wouldn't want to comment on the CIA right this minute, right now, because I haven't done the reporting there, but I could say in that point in time, the Glomar Explorer episode, the entire Project Jennifer, was an example of CIA incompetence. It was also a bad idea. They were told by Craven and Bradley that trying to reach down 3 miles and lift up a Soviet submarine that was probably already quite fragile was a bad idea, especially since that submarine was also quite antiquated, and we knew that it was antiquated, and we knew that there was very little on board that would help us, and there was an easier way to get the code books and the coding machines that would. So it was a $500 million mess. It was also one of the few spy missions that made headlines all over the United States, which also suggests that maybe something went wrong.
Oh, you mean it was a cover-up, essentially?
No, that once a spy mission makes headlines and somebody didn't do their job, because these things are supposed to stay secret, certainly while they're going on.
This is completely a ridiculous question, but did it ever cross your mind, or did you ever wonder if Nixon got his idea to tap the Democratic headquarters after 7 months earlier he had given the go-ahead to tapping the undersea cable?
No, it never crossed my mind. I don't know when Nixon started tapping the Democrats. I don't know when
we
Nixon
don't know
started.
When he started.
I mean,
That's
Nixon
true.
Kept tapes his entire presidency. So I think these two are probably not related. But
it was
know,
a great sort of
know.
Juxtaposition of historical events. While on one hand we were doing a great noble thing.
Oh yeah,
on the domestic shores. It was a criminal act.
And we do point out the juxtaposition. And maybe I shouldn't say no so quickly. I just haven't given it any thought at all. I mean, honestly, I'd have to like research that.
Because it sort of seemed to be the thing to do. How to.
Crazier things have happened. Honestly, I would really have to look at it really closely. We can call Chris, ask him.
Have any movie companies approached you, or do they not option books of this nature?
No, we're talking, and we'll see what happens. It is.
I mean, it seems to me you
because
have...
Because it's somewhat episodic, it's a little bit more complicated to put on film.
But each chapter is a movie.
Or you find ways to draw them all together. So we'll see what happens with that.
Well, good luck with that. Can you tell us what you and Christopher are working on now or what you're working on individually and what we might look forward to?
Well, I think Chris right now is going to spend some time at the New York Times. And I'm basically looking for the next book idea.
Good. Well, we're delighted that you came down today. And we look forward to your next book.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Sherry.
That was Sherry Sontag and Christopher Drew, with interviewer Denise Longto, talking about the writing of Blind Man's Bluff. This book is copyrighted 1998 by Sherry Sontag and Christopher Drew. This recording is copyrighted 1999 by Recorded Books. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends The Candy Bombers, The Untold Story of the Berlin Airlift and America's Finest Hour, by Andre Cherney, narrated by Jonathan Davis. On the 60th anniversary of the Berlin Airlift, Andre Cherney tells a remarkable story with profound implications for our time. Bringing together newly unclassified documents, unpublished letters and diaries, and fresh primary interviews, he tells of the ill-sorted group of cast-offs and second stringers who not only saved millions of desperate people from a dire threat, but also changed how the world viewed the United States, setting in motion the chain of events that would ultimately lead to the dismantling of the Berlin Wall and America's victory in the Cold War. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. Call us toll-free or log on to recordedbooks.com. To learn about our latest releases and special offers, order another recorded book, or to read author interviews and narrator profiles. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.